Welcome to This Week in the Warner Archive Collection, where we discuss our newest releases. I'm George Feltenstein, and I'm proud to be joined by my colleagues, Matt Patterson and D.W. Ferranti.
A dozen delights await you at this week's Warner Archive Collection podcast as we bring you Blu-ray and DVD. And we have items from the small screen as well as items from the big screen. New to Blu-ray from the small screen, and it's never looked this gorgeous even when it first was visible to the public. We have the TV movie classic starring Scott Jacoby, Bad Ronald, from 1974. This is a film that we released on DVD years ago. The quality was NSG, not so good, but think of what's happened over the years. We've been able to remaster films and now remaster them for Blu-ray. And this TV movie is just meant for your Blu-ray collection. It's a fan favorite. New to DVD, we have Deception, the complete series. This was on network television recently for 13 episodes. And all 13 episodes are in this DVD collection. Then we have a film that is new to DVD in its widescreen format. Door to Door with William H. Macy. Based on a true story, really wonderful, critically acclaimed performance from Mr. Macy. And we could say it's back in print, but this is the first time it's available in 16x9 widescreen. Then we have a slew of products that are available back in print on DVD. Most importantly, Superman, the theatrical serials collection, which has the 1948 Superman serial and Ataman versus Superman from 1950. We're going to be talking about that in detail more. Next, we have the four films that Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland starred in together that had nothing to do with Andy Hardy. Babes in Arms from 1939, Strike Up the Band from 1940, Babes on Broadway from 1941, and the Gershwins' Girl Crazy from 1943. We also have more television movies that are returning to DVD. Murder in Mississippi from 1989 and The Plot to Kill Hitler from 1990. And then last but not least, two films from the new millennium. Cellular from 2004 and Mel Gibson starring in Edge of Darkness from 2010. Not to be confused with the Errol Flynn film of the same name. So much to discuss, but let's get started with everything that's good about Bad Ronald.
For fans of a certain age, and it's actually a very broad age, I would say Bad Ronald's hold on the consciousness stretched across maybe two generations of genre fans. And it's an interesting thing because although the film had a life in syndication and had a VHS release, it's one of those films that is most remembered as, I saw this movie once about a guy living in the walls. And it's something that people saw that made an impression. But, you know, you would tell people, oh, that's Bad Ronald. They're like, oh, it really is one of the outstanding movies of the week of the 70s.
And like a movie hiding in your very own walls.
Yeah.
A Blu-ray is popping out.
It looks definitely, as George said, better than it ever looked, including during broadcast.
Without question.
And this was a TV movie that was not released in theaters. So nobody has really ever seen it like this.
It looks amazingly good. This film actually has a terrific cast.
Beyond Scott Jacoby,
Dabney Coleman, Pippa Scott. And its source material, which is this movie's plenty dark. The book is even darker, but the source material was written by one of my favorite writers, Jack Vance, who's mostly known as a science fantasy writer. And he's a beautiful, beautiful elegiac writer. I mean, if you haven't read his stuff, read his stuff. But this comes from his dark imagination as well.
So to give you a little background, and we'll just spend a brief amount of time talking about it, the late 60s saw an upswing in productions made specifically for television, and it was ABC and specifically Barry Diller, who is an executive at ABC at the time in the late 60s, to come up with the movie of the week. And this was on Tuesday nights from, I think, 8:30 to 10 o'clock. It was in a 90-minute time slot, and the term movie of the week, or MOW, became an industry term for almost any made-for-television film when the movie of the week was ABC's dedicated attempt to know that consumers could turn into ABC every Tuesday night at 8:30 and see a new movie that was basically fitting into a 90-minute time slot, meaning about 70 minutes, 72 minutes of film. And they would change change in genre. Some were comedies, some were romantic comedies, some were sophisticated comedies, some of them were dark dramas. And the ones that really seemed to resonate were the ones that would fall into the genre category. Horror, science fiction, mystery, suspense. It basically led the charge to a raft of imitation from other networks really ramping up their TV movie production. And this lasted probably 15, 20 years until the network television movie gave way to the cable television movie.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
network television movies in general, whether they be made for TV or Hollywood theatricals, vanished from the airwaves with the rise of cable television. So it was definitely a product of its time. But some of the made for TV movies have lived on to great success. And when we started Warner Archive Collection in 2009, a few months into our early year, the first year,
right.
we decided to have a whole month of really important TV movies that people were asking for like crazy and had never been released on DVD before. Some of them had never been released on home video before. But then there were others like Bad Ronald that were available on VHS and Betamax in the very, very early days of video cassette and disappeared. So by our releasing them on DVD, it brought them to a new generation. And Bad Ronald, along with Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, mm-hmm. were among our most popular selling titles when we first launched the business back in 2009.
How many people saw these films when they first aired? This was truly a communal watching experience when it first happened. And then it, like, disappeared.
Well, beyond that, though, I mean, there were three networks.
Yeah.
So the chances are the number of viewers that would watch a movie the week like Bad Ronald was the many millions. And out of that many
Tens.
Millions, they were definitely school kids. And
yeah.
out of those school kids, they were definitely other school kids that weren't necessarily allowed to stay up that late
yeah.
or just missed it. And then a movie like this becomes a schoolyard legend.
An urban legend.
Kids
yeah.
tell each other this story.
The next day in
yeah.
school.
And there's slight changes to it, and it becomes
yeah.
part of the urban folklore of generations of school kids.
And within a year and a half or 2 years, suddenly they're syndicated and shown all the time by local stations. And so these films became very, very well known. But certain ones resonated for years after, and Bad Ronald was one of them because of its disturbing Twilight Zonian
yeah.
mm-hmm. Plot, you know, really.
A killer kid lives in your walls.
Let's just briefly the plot, if you don't know it. Scott Jacoby plays a young, talented artist with, shall we say, a fragile social grip in reality.
And a very nice pair of glasses.
And a super mm-hmm. overprotected mother, and after he accidentally kills
yeah.
a neighbor, she creates a
spoiler,
a false wall, and he gets walled up in a house, which is then subsequently sold. So this innocent suburban family moves into a house that already has an inhabitant.
And under the stairs is Harry Potter, and they never even open the door to
no,
find
they,
out. Just kidding. But Bad Ronald is something that will stay with you and haunt you, which is exactly what the creators intended long after your first viewing. And that's what has kept it popular and why we've brought it to Blu-ray.
And that's why I've taken the disc out of the case and hidden it in other cases.
That's a great idea. So when we have a success like this, we want to bring it to Blu-ray and make sure that it looks superb. And this really looks better than anyone ever intended for a low-budget made-for-television movie. It is just
the
perfect.
The details on and the set work, it's a wonderful fashion and home decor timepiece that I almost wanted to step in it, and I wanted to refurbish and resell the house because that house would sell for a lot of money today.
Just like the Brady's house did. So
oh,
you never know. Anyway, we go from classic television of the 70s to television of just yestermonth.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
this is a series that was running on network television only a few months ago for 13 episodes and then came to an end. But we bring you the whole complete series, Deception.
This show is a lot of fun. Similar template where you've got, you know, the FBI is teamed up with, and in this case, a professional magician who offers his repertoire of tricks to capture other tricksters.
Now, the film, the series, has an interesting setup because it has that familiar premise, but then it also sort of...
got a great twist.
It leavens in this sort of the arc series format, so if you're fans of stuff like Blindspot, mm-hmm. as well as shows like The Mentalist, it inhabits a world that has elements of both. Actually, for a show that focuses on its main character, who's this, like, former superstar magician played by Jack Cutmore Scott and his twin brother, who's been framed for murder. So yeah. You've got a fugitive storyline, you've got a crime of the week storyline, you've got an evil arcing twins. Threat, and you also have some very complicated lessons in sleight of hand and escapology and all the elements of magic, big and small. And I have to point out, there's an engineer played by Vinnie Jones.
But this kind of reveals a little bit behind the scenes. There really aren't too many procedurals of magic.
And that's a part of the show is unique. Is he breaks down the deceptions that they're pulling to get away with their
right.
stuff.
And I found that kind of fascinating because you've seen a lot of cop procedurals, but magic procedurals are few to none.
And if you're a fan of BBC genre shows, Lenore Criclo from Being Human's in this.
This is one of those shows that probably if it was not falling victim to this, if the network doesn't own it, yep. we're not going to keep it on the air. It's one of those kind of shows. It really deserved to run longer, in my opinion. But we're glad that we have the 13 episodes to bring to you, and you can get Deception, the complete series. Whatever.com is your destination to purchase Warner Archive products. So we hope you enjoyed Deception. Now we move on to Door to Door, a tug at your heart true story with a fantastic performance by William H. Macy. It's one of those made-for-television movies of the modern era, originally premiered on TNT, that made quite an impact when it first was
just about
made.
16 years ago.
It's hard to believe that it's been that long.
Picked up a score of awards, including the prestigious Peabody. It tells the true story of a very successful door-to-door salesman by the name of Bill Porter, whose career pretty much, when he retired, was pretty much when door-to-door salesmaning was ending. And what makes Bill Porter rather unique in his field is that he had cerebral palsy, and he started working at a time when it was considered impossible for someone with cerebral palsy to have this job. By virtue of his perseverance and charm, he became one of the most successful door-to-door salesmen in his field.
And it's a true story, and it is epic. Just...
it's like an epic tale of a salesman.
And his mom is Helen Mirren, so you know he's off to a good start.
Well, can't get better than that. And when it came time to bring this film back into print, we decided to do it the right way and do what wasn't done originally, and that is use the 16:9 widescreen format that the director intended. So it looks really great. It sounds really great.
But this is a good example of the evolution of the TV movie,
oh, exactly.
as we were talking. Because when I first watched this, I didn't know it was a TV movie. I thought it was a movie in theaters right. in the early 2000s.
And the thing about these kinds of stories is that there became no place for them mm-hmm. to find an audience in a movie theater,
right.
with rare exception.
Yep.
Stories about people that were not mega budget, extravaganzas started to become rare in the last few decades. And those kinds of stories found a home on cable television after network television.
It's a character actor tour de force.
And it really establishes William H. Mm-hmm. Macy as a shameless... No, just kidding. No, truly, one of the really great actors of our time, who for a long time was unappreciated and now is renowned for his yeah. unique qualities as an actor.
And he played a big part in bringing this film to the small screen.
Absolutely.
And it shows. I do love at the very end, they show contemporaneous that he eventually got a website. So you didn't have to go door to door anymore. But it was like this website promo at the end. And I'm like, oh.
I thought that was a cute twist.
Yeah.
So it's back door to door. Now we're briefly going to talk about all these films that are back in print on DVD. And then we're going to really concentrate on one of the releases that is quite special because it didn't get as much attention when it first got released to retail stores. And now that we're bringing it back, we're going to spend a little more time talking about it. But before we do, we want to remind you that the four essential Mickey Judy musicals are now available individually for the very first time on DVD. Babes in Arms from 1939, Strike Up the Band from 1940, Babes on Broadway from 1941, and the remake of George and Ira Gershwin's Girl Crazy from 1943. So that means Warner Archive brings you two different Girl Crazies if you look hard enough, because we also have the first film version with Wheeler and Woolsey.
They all have tons of extras.
And they all make you want to put on a show.
That's right. Each one of the plots was surprisingly familiar. Even Girl Crazy, which was based on a Broadway show that had been written 13 years before, somehow had that let's put on a show vibe. Then we have a real salacious and seductive Murder in Mississippi made for television movie from 1989 that dealt with the civil rights movement, and a story that was more recently told on the big screen with Tom Cruise and Valkyrie. This is The Plot to Kill Hitler in 1990. It was a TV movie that was dealing with the same story elements. Then we also have two theatrical releases, the New Line thriller from 2004, Cellular.
Which I forgot starred Chris Evans.
Oh,
This is Chris Evans long before he was Captain America.
This movie is one of those ones that kind of fits in that it's recent but not recent enough, but when you watch it, everyone's so young.
Yes, except for Kim.
Jason Statham. It's just
his hair.
He has a little bit. He shaved it.
Right.
It's a Hitchcockian suspense thriller about your cell phone battery dying
in 2004.
So think about it. It was still a flip phone back then.
Oh, they were flip phones,
and they were not smartphones. And then from 2010, we have Edge of Darkness, which was a Mel Gibson return to Warner Brothers in 2010, and he'll be returning again. We just found out for a remake of The Wild Bunch. But Edge of Darkness is a good thriller, no relation to the Errol Flynn film of the same name, which we also have. But now it's back in print on DVD. But the most exciting back in print title that we're going to spend a little time talking about today are Superman, the theatrical series collection. And we say are because there are, in fact, two serials contained in this collection. There's the original Superman serial from 1948, starring Kirk Allen as the Man of Steel. And then from 1950, Atom Man versus Superman, also starring Kirk Allen. And these were originally released by Columbia Pictures and produced by the infamous producer of low-budget fare, Sam Katzman. But the rights reverted to DC Comics, and that's how they ended up here at Warner Brothers. And for those of you who don't know, and we think most of our listeners do know, but theatrical serials were also known as chapters. They would be shown on Saturday matinees for kids in the middle of two feature films and trailers and cartoons and newsreels and whatnot. And kids would go to the theater every week, hopefully, to see the next chapter in their favorite serial. And there would be, this is not the kind of cereal that you eat, folks. This is a serialized story in 20-minute sections, and Flash Gordon was put together this way for the big screen, and there were tons of Western serials and space serials. And what's interesting is that Warner Brothers didn't make serials, MGM didn't make serials, and RKO, I think, distributed a few but didn't own any. So the only serials in our library are these. So it's unique, primarily the fodder of the smaller studios like Republic and Universal to make serials, and Columbia made serials, but the studios that make up the bulk of our library did not. And it's interesting that there was a Batman serial that Columbia made in the 40s, and Columbia retained the rights to that. When they wanted to make the Superman serial in 1948, the people at, what was it called?
National Periodical Publications. Yeah. I would attribute that, and I don't know, this is pure conjecture on my part, but Whitney Ellsworth, who was sort of the steward of Superman at the time, was very canny and very forward-thinking. He ended up shepherding the Superman TV series, so I'm not surprised that there was a codicil where it reverted, because Whitney Ellsworth always had plans for Superman that involved him continually to grow.
Speaking of the television series, there is a very important connection between the television series and these serials, and that is that Lois Lane is portrayed by no other than Noel Neal.
And one of the directors of the majority of both serials was one of the main directors on the TV series. And you will also see set pieces that they use in the TV series in this series.
They're very closely tethered and related. However, these were unseen for decades.
And a lot of that is probably due, I would think, to the enormous success of the TV series and syndication because they brought back the Republic, not just the Republic, but they brought back the movie serials in various packages.
Even the Batman serial came back in the 60s when the Adam West.
And so, I mean, I grew up watching movie serials on television in weird hours all the time, but not this one.
They would be in odd times because they had odd running times.
Yeah.
So what's really important to note here is this is the first, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, the first live-action representation of Superman, on the motion picture screen.
And what is kind of ironic is one of the studios that passed on Sam Katzman saying, I am Superman, was Republic, because they thought it would be too difficult to do the flying scenes, which I guess means someone at Republic forgot that they had already made The Adventures of Captain Marvel.
Or maybe they didn't want to be bothered, because one of the things that's unique is these are done on a very low budget, but considering they were done on such a low budget, they're very clever in how they execute it, and Superman's flying sequences are actually animation that works pretty well.
Yeah, at first it's a little startling, but then the more you watch it, the more you just accept it.
I think at the time, because Captain Marvel had flown, probably, at least in the little bit of research I did, I think the people at the time saw it as kind of a cheat or a way out. But as a modern audience member, it actually looks more expensive. Like, I loved the fluidity of the flying.
Yeah, and the other thing to remember is on the big screen, people had already been used to seeing an animated Superman thanks to the Fleischer cartoons, which were enormously popular.
And that's what it evokes.
And I want to sort of point out, there's someone, maybe me, should write a biography of Superman as a fictional character, not a fictional biography, because each media incarnation of Superman has added to and changed him as a character.
And the lore.
Yeah. And from the comic book to the comic strip, the comic strip changed story elements. The radio drama is so much more influential than people realize. Because they haven't listened to it. Hold on.
All right. I'm just excited.
What's really sort of fascinating about this depiction is, and they'll say in the credits, based on the radio
show.
That's
what I was going to say.
This is very much riffs off of the Bud Collier, "This is a job for Superman," where Bud Collier played Clark Kent very light and Superman very strong. And Kirk Allen is great, especially as Clark Kent. His Clark Kent is a different character than Superman, and it's an approach to the character that we wouldn't see on the big screen again
until
Christopher Reeve.
Right.
And if you watch these, there's no question that these serials were part of what Donner looked at, and they're definitely what Christopher Reeve looked at.
It then feels like that.
To continue the complication, if you watch the Fleischer cartoons, and then you watch The Adventures of Superman, George Reeves definitely looked towards the Fleischers because his Clark Kent is just like the cartoon Clark Kent, who was a very serious, tough reporter.
And they were probably conscious of making it more different from the earlier film.
Yeah,
but
film
we should
versions.
Also remember that at that time, people did not have the luxury that we have today of accessing
everything.
All these different iterations and looking at them and comparing them.
We can do this in an hour.
Yeah, and one of the great things about these serials is the second serial introduces Lex Luthor, and he is introduced right in the beginning, like opening lines of exposition. You mean Superman's arch nemesis? So by this time, Lex Luthor had gone from a nothing character to the main bad guy, and they have Lyle Talbot, who's no slouch when it comes to acting credits, playing Luthor, and Lyle Talbot's Luthor is so good and so what you actually think of Luthor. No offense to Gene Hackman, who's a genius.
I love the setup and the origin story in the serial kind of more than the TV show. I love the animated planet blowing up.
And it's Eben and Sarah Kent instead of Jonathan and Martha, which...
True.
It shows what I was made.
The setup is wonderful, and that's the first three episodes. And then it feels very Superman-y if you cut to the second one and you get to Lex Luthor.
And if you're a fan of our gang, you'll really enjoy the actor that plays Jimmy Olsen.
That's right. It's Tommy Bond, who started with the Our Gang comedies as Tommy Bond and then took like a year or two hiatus and came back as Butch.
Butch.
And he's also in our Monogram Pictures classic Hot Rod with Jimmy Lydon.
Right.
So he's no stranger to whack at all. But these serials were available, I think they were first released on DVD in 2006, and it was in conjunction with Superman Returns, the theatrical movie of that year. Then they've gone out of print and been rare and hard to find. And so
until
Exactly. Until now, they're available for you to own, and it's a unique addition to your Superman library if you don't already own them, and we think that there are probably a lot of people that don't know these were even released. So we hope that you'll take the opportunity to add them to your library, because if you're a super fan, you have to own this iteration of Superman.
Ooh.
And that makes up the 12 releases this week, but now is the part of our podcast where we share with you, the listener, letters that consumers have sent us to ask us questions about what we're doing here at the Warner Archive. And Matt, where can people send such missives if they want to get a stamp and an envelope and send us a letter?
Warner Archive Podcast, 3400 Riverside Drive, B160-4, Burbank, California, 91522. And we're going to start today with a letter from Tom from Meadville, Pennsylvania. And this one has Dan on front, so Dan's going to open this one.
In case it's personal.
In case it's personal. This is,
or poison.
Yeah, direct, addressed directly to me, so this is, you know...
We don't know what happens before we read them.
This is my invitation to Matt. It's typed. Appears to be a Helvetica font. Hello, Dan. I wanted to thank you for the swag you recently sent me. It far exceeded my expectations. I had included a 9x12 manila sace with my letter to the podcast. My only thinking there was if you were to send a post, there would be one less time it would need to be folded. You did indeed include the Dirty Dozen post mentioned on the podcast. Any poster with a tagline that says, stick it to the Nazis, is always great. Amen. You also included Space Ghost and Adventures of Superboy, signed by Gerard Christopher. They were a real surprise. I never expected actual Warner Archive DVDs at swag. I was only thinking promotional material. I do not have either DVD and have been greatly enjoying both. They were the sort of items I would love to receive as a birthday present. Happy birthday, then. But no one would think to get them for me, nor would I even think to ask for them. Thanks again for the swag and for the podcast. The Warner Archive is a fun place to escape to every couple weeks. Thank you. I appreciate the insight and perspective each of you brings to every episode. Tom from Meadville, Pennsylvania. By the way, Meadville, Pennsylvania's claim to Hollywood fame is the birthplace of Academy Award nominee and Golden Globe and Emmy winner Sharon Stone. And in the interest of fairness, two-time Razzie winner as well.
Well,
thank you, Tom.
It's my basic instinct not to make the kind of joke I want to make right now. So I'm not going to.
I'm going to cross my legs.
That was what I wasn't going to say.
I'm going to point out that what he says is if you include a self-addressed stamped envelope, Daniel here can put some things inside.
Well,
you
let's
never
see
know what
the next letter
get.
Has to say.
All right, next letter. Dan, you can see how difficult it is to read these
letters.
I
know, it's nerve-wracking.
Yeah. It's not in crayon.
This one is... from someone too shy to be named.
Oh, he who must not be named.
Dear Warner Archive,
Newt Scamander.
Hello to you guys. I've been following your work for many years, but have never taken the step to write you at your podcast until now. While you have introduced me to many things I've never heard before, I admit to having a favorite corner of your library, that being Hanna-Barbera, Ruby Spears, MGM Animation, that side of your family. I have loved many of your efforts to expand these libraries to DVD and bring some back in print. There is one part, though, that as long as I've been a fan has been part of a confusion to me. That part is many of the specials produced and whether or not they are part of your library. While some of the specials with popular characters are easy, a lot of the ones based on literature or other brands aren't as obvious. Some of us aren't sure which ones work or work for hire or the property of Southern Star Hanna-Barbera Australia.
Aha!
I could rely on other secondhand reports, but I know of several that in the past didn't think you guys owned the 70s version of The Three Musketeers, but then it came out in one of your sets. So I decided to go to the closest source possible, you guys. So, currently, do you have all the specials like those made by Hanna-Barbera or Ruby Spears in your library left to release to DVD? If you do, are there enough for more collections like the one you did with the Musketeers? Or would we be talking more about specials on another show's disc like RoboForce on the GoBots DVD? In general, please keep up all the good work on everything you do for each part of the library. Your work is always a pleasure to follow.
First of all, Hanna-Barbera did have a joint venture with an Australian firm. And because of that, most of those productions were not those to which Hanna-Barbera retained rights. Therefore, they are not part of our library. However, there are still many Hanna-Barbera specials that are part of our library that we haven't released yet. Some of them we have the rights to, but there are clearance issues involved, some of which may not be clearable. And I don't mean to be vague, but it's a very, very large and complicated list of properties. So just know we're always doing our best to try to bring you as much of the classic animation, and in some cases, live action, that Hanna-Barbera put together that we can bring to you. And we've done quite a bit of it in the last 10 years.
Oh, well, we've gone into the depths.
Yes, the Bermuda depths.
Oh, there we go.
I think it's time for another letter.
All right.
But thank you to that he who must not be named.
Too shy to be named.
Too shy.
This is from Michael from Irvington, New York.
Hello, Michael.
Michael has written to us before.
Well, because I've been to Irvington in my youth.
I
remember
recognize.
Somebody's written from there.
Oh, yeah.
They had a nifty old movie theater, so I never went in it, but I used to get driven by it when I was a child. So.
All right, here we go. Gentlemen, your podcast is such a celebration of film that I listen to every episode, even back-to-back episodes, learning about films I love and discovering new films to watch. I write with questions about the 1962 film The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm, which I believe to have been one of very few released in three-screen Cinerama. The clips available on YouTube show a bizarre distorted topology, widening towards the end and smaller in the middle, mimicking the effect of the original projection, I suspect. The picture was filmed in Rothenburg ob der Taube, a curious town that was sacked so hard during the 30 Years' War it had experienced virtually no development until the 20th century, leaving it a picture-perfect storybook town, and appears in such films ranging from Pinocchio to Harry Potter to MGM's own Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm. I visited Rothenburg last month and returned curious to see the film, but it appears to have never been released in any format since VHS, not counting some Region 2 PAL formatted DVDs of questionable provenance.
Well, it was released on Laserdisc, too.
Oh, there you go. And some articles online suggest that you intended to release it on DVD in 2011. But what's the story? Is the bizarre format a barrier? How will you handle that for normal, i.e. rectangular screens? Can we expect The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm anytime soon? Best, Michael.
Great and complicated question.
Complicated.
Okay, so we'll try to answer this as quickly and as clearly as possible. The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm and How the West Was Won were the two narrative films made by MGM in partnership with Cinerama Incorporated. Cinerama, of course, was the very famous widescreen process that preceded CinemaScope. Cinerama used three cameras rigged together in synchronicity, and the three cameras would therefore provide three strips of 35mm film that, when projected, would enwrap you, basically.
Right. From three projectors.
Three projectors perfectly synced up, and there would be join lines, very slight, in between the three panel. So it was very cumbersome and it was very expensive. And a lot of non-narrative films, documentaries and travelogues had been made using the process. And then MGM and Cinerama joint ventured on these two narrative films, Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm and How the West Was Won. The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm opened in the U.S. first, and How the West Was Won opened internationally at the same time. Mm. Now, you may ask why. That's because there weren't very many Cinerama theaters, because you had to be equipped with that special projection and the tracks. And if you've been in a booth where they're running Cinerama, it's an enormous task. The plan was to open Brothers Grimm in the U.S. and How the West Was Won internationally and then flop them the next year. So we didn't get How the West Was Won until until the year after in this country, and internationally they got Brothers Grimm the year after as well. The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm was a very ambitious production. It was not particularly successful, and it was not particularly well received. Although, because it was Cinerama and the gimmick of Cinerama was so intriguing, that for a film of its budget and stature, it didn't completely fizzle. However, How the West Was Won was nothing but a box office triumph. And when it came to this country and Grimm went overseas, Grimm similarly kind of tanked at the box office overseas, while How the West Was Won did incredible business here as well as it did internationally. How the West Was Won was eventually re-released on a single 70mm print in, I think, 1969 or 70, to give you a wider screen experience with obvious join lines. But Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm did not get a big theatrical release post-Cinerama, re-release like that. Mm. What it did get, and How the West Was Won got this as well, they made 35mm anamorphic / Panavision / CinemaScope release prints that could be shown in regular theaters, where the join lines from the three panels were obvious. And it is from those 35mm scope intermediate elements that were reductions from the three panels that the initial How the West Was Won and Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm television versions and videotape versions and laserdisc versions were created from. They don't look very, very good.
Because you have so many generations of material.
We did work with a very talented gentleman by the name of Dave Strohmeyer, who is Mr. Cinerama. I think he would deserve that title. He did a wonderful documentary chronicling the history of the process and has been working with the Cinerama Library, which is now owned by Pacific Theaters, which is the successor and interest to Cinerama. And Dave lent his talents and his documentary and his Smilebox format to help us release How the West Was Won on Blu-ray using the Smilebox format and the technology that we have today, which could finally eliminate the join lines and create one unified picture. And we really did the optics both ways, so you could have a traditional wide, widescreen letterbox that's completely rectangular, or the CinemaScope, not the CinemaScope, the Cinerama recreation using the Smilebox.
Because it had distortion on the sides.
That's right. And we were able to correct for the distortion and also correct for the problems in the join lines to actually create a better viewing experience than you could even get in the original theatrical experience.
Interesting sidebar about smile boxes. I had a very angry comment about our release of Billy Budd claiming that the smile box cover artwork was deceptive because it indicated that Billy Budd should have been in Cinerama. And I don't even know how to unpack that insanity.
The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm original camera negative was severely water damaged in the underground tunnels of the MGM lot. Oh. And in order to create a master like we did for How the West Was Won would be incredibly expensive. And there is a lot of internet chatter about this, saying, oh, gee, well, you know, Warner Brothers does everything themselves and makes everything very expensive, and Dave could do it for much less money.
Dave could do it for a dollar.
Dave has gone online saying this would not be an easy restoration at all, but some people seem to be blind to his words. We don't know when that could happen. We could take a cheap, easy way out and use the reduction element to put out a release of Brothers Grimm that is compromised in that fashion, but until we have the tools to be able to do it right, or there's some benevolent, wealthy person out there who wants to endow us. We are a public company, folks. We have to earn a profit on our releases, which is why we try to do the best that we can with every release and to meet various fans for their wants. There are some films that present particular challenges and problems. Unfortunately, Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm is one of those films that presents those challenges. And unless we're willing to compromise on quality, which at the present time. We're not. There is no plan at the present time to release the film, given the problems with the elements and the huge cost related to it. That's the honest answer. So I think that's pretty much it. Are we going to have any more letters, or is that it for today?
That is all for today.
Well, your mailbag was empty, but we shouldn't let any podcast end without mentioning our wonderful, wonderful Warner Archive Room on iTunes. And the Warner Archive Room on iTunes is the place where you can buy digital downloads or rent digital downloads of great motion pictures from our library, spanning from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond, as well as great television programs, television series, animated cartoons. And you can also buy classic soundtrack albums from Water Tower Music, our sister company that handles our fantastic soundtracks. And you can also find the 300 plus podcasts we've been recording here since 2009, which are free, all at the Warner Archive Room on iTunes. You can go to itunes.com/Warner Archive, or if you're in iTunes movies section, you can go to the classic genre, and then down at the bottom of the classics main page, you'll find what they call the swoosh with various displays, and one of them is Warner Archive. Click on that and it'll take you right into the room. And we will be adding over 100 additional features from our classic library to the Warner Archive Room on iTunes in a very, very short amount of time. So when that happens, you can hear about it first either at our Facebook page or from our Twitter feed or on this podcast, whichever happens sooner. And I think another podcast is about to happen anytime soon, because we're going to be back next week with a whole new slew of new releases. But until that time, I am George Feltenstein.
I'm Matt Patterson.
The Wilby House is haunted by a ghost who isn't dead.
Thanks for listening, and look forward to the next Warner Archive podcast.